Technology has made the world a smaller place, but there is still so much we do not know. Every week, Postcards takes you on a trip of exploration and discovery. From a small village in Afghanistan to a protected cultural heritage site in South America. From Africa's amazing natural landscapes to the most advanced tech displays in the world. Postcards, where you meet the world without actually taking a trip. Postcards.
Hello and welcome to Postcards, a show which takes you across borders without actually leaving home. I'm Wen Jie. While Rio de Janeiro prepares to host Olympic beach volleyball at Copacabana, on the famous beach itself, the sport is being replaced by new variants on the theme. Foot volley is now one of the most popular games among the locals. Here's Michael Butterworth with this postcard from Brazil.
The sunny sands of Rio de Janeiro's Copacabana beach are filled with sun seekers. But few people here seek out sun loungers, with many preferring a more active day at the beach. At Leme, on the northeast end of the beach, the beach volleyball arena is the newest feature. Beach volleyball has long been one of the most popular sports on the sands of Rio's famous beaches. Each day, former beach volleyball player Robinildo Quintino Alves arrives to teach early morning classes. Many of his pupils are foreigners passing through or living in the city. On Saturday mornings, various Japanese residents come for lessons. Jinpei Saito is a volleyball player.
It is a release from stress, something to look forward to every week. I experience real life when I practice beach volleyball with my friends.
Keisuke Kitayama is another volleyball player.
Beach volley is one of the most popular sports in Brazil. When I came to Brazil, I play soccer, but I wanted to do some marine sports. This is the best, and it's, I think, easiest to practice or to play.
Alves says the Olympics has spurred more people on to try the iconic game.
Volleyball has always been popular because it is a recreational sport and can be played with a lax approach to the rules. And now with the Olympics, the demand for it has increased as well as for all sports in general.
But volleyball is just one of many sports competing for a space on the sands of Rio de Janeiro. Another well-known beach classic is Fresco Ball. The players don't compete, but instead try to keep the fun going by keeping the ball in the air for as long as possible. Another local speciality is Altinho, or high ball, which is played near the sea. Once again, the idea is not to let the ball touch the ground. It's only allowed to be played after 4 p.m, so as not to annoy children with their parents and swimmers. No scores are kept here, but the longer the ball stays in the air, the greater the fun. Along the beach, many hundreds of volleyball nets are being taken over by foot volleyball teams, which is proving increasingly popular. At Leme Beach on weekends, this group of friends is joined by a famous teammate, Jair Ventura Filho, a former football champion in the 1970s when Brazil won its third FIFA World Cup. The football legend claims to be one of the inventors of the sport.
It was invented here in Rio by myself and others before me. Before, we called it control. Now it's foot volleyball. It's the same as volleyball, but you don't use your hands. You can touch the ball with all other parts of the body, but not the hands. Do you know what I mean?
Leo Tubarão is a foot volley promoter and instructor on Copacabana Beach. He says it's becoming the dominant sport on the beach.
Now we have 5 foot volleyball nets. It's become a real passion and a national passion. Today, various artists and former football players practice foot volleyball as a way of keeping fit without the risk of injuring themselves.
For sports lovers coming to Rio to enjoy the Olympic Games, it seems that not all the action is to be found in the stadia.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. The production of traditional cashmere is under threat, following increasingly unpredictable climates in the few parts of the world where it can be found. The goat hair is one of the most prized commodities in the fashion industry. And unlike cotton, silk, or leather, it depends on natural grasslands, which makes it more vulnerable to climate change. Now, some producers are turning to yak and camel hair for a more sustainable alternative to goat cashmere. Here's Nick Lanigan with this postcard from Mongolia.
Goats and sheep graze, overlooked by the mountains of Bayan Khongor, Mongolia. 90% of Mongolia is classified as fragile dry land. In 2010, the combined impact of summer drought and an extreme winter known as a dzud killed more than 9 million livestock in the country, of which most were cashmere goats. Many herders have increased their herd sizes as an insurance policy, and this has resulted in overgrazing. Enk Amgalan Tsili is program coordinator at the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation in Mongolia. She says 70% of the rangelands in the country have been degraded. Of about 56 million livestock animals in Mongolia, roughly 20 million are goats. The result is a decline in the quality of cashmere.
The number of goats are increasing in a way that the carrying capacity of the rangelands are exceeded by the number of goats. And herders are increasing the goats because the cashmere has been very high-priced, high-value product. So that's why I think that in the recent years that quality of the cashmere has been declining because when the rangelands are degraded, the goats are not having enough nutrition, and that it has started to affect the quality of the product, the fiber.
Climate change and overgrazing, along with a growing demand for cashmere overseas, have resulted in a shortage in the supply of global cashmere. The once expensive commodity has now permeated high street brands like H&M and Zara in the democratization of fashion, with quantity driving down quality. As a result, a growing number of cashmere brands are turning to alternative fibers, including cashmere from yak and baby camels.
Quality of cashmere is getting more coarser, and it affects the quality of the product, so they start looking for some alternative fiber which can replace cashmere. So recently, our local Mongolian researchers have found that if baby camels are combed at very young age, and yaks are combed if their wool is harvested at very young age, it's almost the same quality as cashmere. The average micron of fineness of yak wool and baby camel wool and baby yak wool is almost exactly the same as cashmere, and it's even longer.
One of the new brands that has emerged as part of this trend is Hangai Mountain Textiles. Hangai works with 100% pure, undyed yak fibre, a more sustainable alternative, the company says. Unlike goats, which feed on grass, yaks graze in mountainous regions several thousand metres above sea level, causing less damage to the land. Now pursuing wholesale distribution among high-end retailers in mountain resorts in the United States, such as Aspen, Colorado, the Infantes predict a growing market for Mongolian yak products in America. Bettina Morera Infante is the founder of Hangai Mountain Textiles.
The U.S. market is flooded with cashmere, particularly from China, because they're the largest producer. So yak is different. It is rare. It's unique. It has a beautiful story behind it that for us is special because it's integral to herding communities in Mongolia. we decided to visit the Hangai, which is where the bulk of the Mongolian yak is sourced from, to visit the herder families and stay with them and see how they hand comb the yak fiber from the yak in the spring. And it's just a very sustainable, benign process that we respect. So we work with those entrepreneurs and those knitters and weavers that have the same values that we have, and that we can encourage to harvest these fibers sustainably.
Ulzibodija Bodio Jabal grew up in the Gobi Desert, knowing firsthand the challenges faced by Mongolian herders, including low incomes, as well as harsh winters and summer droughts. He also saw an opportunity in ecologically sustainable alternatives to goat cashmere, along with higher prices for herders. Jambal founded his own yak and knitwear company, Bodios of Mongolia, which specializes in yak and camel wool. By buying these above market rates, he aims to support his community and protect the land.
So everybody says that so many cashmere goats not good for the earth, it's not friendly. But at the same time, it's herders most income from the cashmere. Then now we just think cashmere prices it's much less goats. If cashmere prices going down, herders wants to grow more cashmere goats, which means cashmere prices a little bit up. It's our goal.
80% of Bodio's products are now yak, along with 10% camel wool. Most of its products are exported, namely to Russia, along with North America and Europe, where Jambal says demand for environmentally friendly products is rising.
Customer wants to buy what is the trade fair, what is the organic, what is the environmental. It's very important right now. Our customers are very educated. It's luxury products. Those guys want to buy how they can help to the environmental world, and they want to use organic fibers. It's a good future of our business, I think.
As the supply of high-quality cashmere continues to shrink, the pursuit of alternative fibers is likely to grow, giving retailers and herders alike greater options.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. Scientists in the UK are giving praying mantises tiny 3D spectacles to find out more about how their three-dimensional vision works. Newcastle University researchers are hoping that understanding more about how the mantises see could help to develop new kinds of 3D technology for computers and robots. Here's Zhao Jianfu with this postcard from the UK.
It may look like a fashion statement, but these bespectacled bugs are actually helping scientists create artificial 3D vision. These are mantises, and uniquely among insects, they have multidimensional sight, although they only see in black and white. Their 3D glasses look like any pair we would wear, but because they can't see red, their specs are blue and green. Experiments devised by researchers in the 1980s already proved these insects do see in 3D. What the scientists here at Newcastle University want to do is find out more about how their 3D vision works. Lead scientist Jenny Reed explains that it's the mantis' single-minded efficiency as a hunter that make it a good target to study.
One of the great things about mantises is that they kind of tell us what they're seeing via their natural responses. So they can't move their eyes within their head, so if they see something interesting, they tend to move their head around to look at it. And they also have this strike response. So they're predatory insects, and if they see something that they think they can grab, they'll reach out and try and snatch it.
The researchers have built a miniature 3D cinema for the bugs to test their 3D perception. the fluttering across the screen imitates that movement of a bug. When it's behind the black and white shapes, the mantis leaves it alone. But the insects watch carefully, and when the shape flutters in front, the mantis strikes.
We display moving simulated bugs that we hope look like tasty mantis dinner. And we use the 3D to manipulate the distance at which we think the bugs should appear. And sure enough, when the bugs were manipulated to be presented at a long distance, say behind the screen, the mantises would look at them, so we know they can see them, but they wouldn't reach out and try and catch them.
The mantises do not try to catch the bugs when they are shown in 2D, but as soon as they appear in 3D, the insects pounce.
When we presented a bug floating in front of the screen, within the mantis's catch range, then they did reach out with their spiked forelegs and try and grab the target. And so that's how we know that they are perceiving it in 3D.
The mantises are now part of a special breeding program at Newcastle University. Reed says the mantis's 3D vision is likely to be much simpler than ours. She believes that in the long term, these studies may help scientists to develop simpler 3D for robots, as well as therapies for people with eye conditions such as lazy eye, strabismus, or squint. At the moment, though, the team here is focused on creating a computer software model to recreate the way mantises see.
By presenting a blue image in the blue channel of the computer screen and a different image in the green channel of the computer screen, we can manipulate what's called the disparity between the two images. And it's that shift between the left and right eye images that gives the 3D effect.
She adds that what they're doing at the moment is trying lots of different tests to narrow down exactly how the mantis's vision works.
We're doing experiments to kind of try and work out what they can see, what they can't see, and basically disprove different hypotheses about how their 3D vision works. And as we gradually formulate new hypotheses and either disprove them or find evidence in support of them, then we hope to get closer and closer to replicating the algorithm that they use.
The team is hoping that understanding how the mantises see will give them more information about how 3D vision evolved, and could lead to possible new algorithms for 3D depth perception in computers.
We can gain insight into a whole new form of 3D, which may be quite different from our existing understanding of 3D vision. And the sort of applications I see are sort of lightweight mobile applications, so autonomous drones, for example. Maybe it would make more sense to give them a kind of cheap and cheerful insect 3D vision, rather than trying to base their 3D vision on our own highly sophisticated, complex 3D.
For now at the laboratory, the mantises are enjoying an interval before their matinee performance.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. Robots are helping South African scientists make significant discoveries about climate change. The smart submersible are providing a previously unobtainable window to the ocean and the way it handles excess carbon dioxide. Before we come to the end of today's show, I would like to share with you an extra postcard from South Africa. These submersible wave gliders are providing scientists with cutting-edge climate change data. Before the use of these gliders in the Southern Ocean over the last 5 years, the phytoplankton growing season wasn't really understood. Phytoplankton is to the ocean what trees are to the land. They perform the key task of carbon storage. Because of all the extra carbon dioxide being emitted into the atmosphere because of the burning of fossil fuels by humankind, the natural mechanisms for storing carbon take on a greater significance. Sebastian Swart is an oceanographer at the South African Government's Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. He says the robotic gliders have shown that the microscopic phytoplankton are locking away more harmful carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than was previously thought.
What the gliders were able to observe from spring all the way until late summer was that the spring bloom, so the phytoplankton bloom that occurs in spring, would occur in around September, October. And then we hypothetically thought that, or theoretically we thought that those blooms would die very quickly after that. About a month later, they would run out of nutrients and the bloom would go bust. But the gliders actually showed us that these blooms continued for a much longer period of time than we had seen before, or we weren't able to actually observe that using ships alone. And they showed that the bloom could extend for 3 to 4 months longer than we thought. And that's really important for global climate, because it means that potentially these blooms are absorbing more carbon dioxide during photosynthesis.
Deploying the submersible and wave gliders is much cheaper than using research ships. The gliders send back continuous data over long-term deployments rather than from an occasional short scientific trip by ship or with satellite data, which are limited to the ocean surface. Lead engineer Andre Hoek explains.
The big advantage here is we've got firstly a persistent presence. So we can go out with a big research vessel. The vessel can deploy the robot. The vessel can do a survey, come back to shore, and the robot can stay out 6 months to a year. The other big advantage is there's no fuel bill. It's completely wave-powered. So in terms of ship's cost, that's the biggest cost. 3-4 days on a big research vessel would buy you one of these robots. So in that sense, it's extremely efficient.
The remotely controlled gliders use satellite communications to avoid ships. This South African team has adapted the US-made gliders.
We took an ocean robot that can measure weather, that can navigate, and we augmented that capability by adding an echo sounder to essentially do the same thing a research vessel would do.
Wave and submersible gliders have only been available for the last 5 to 10 years. Being deployed in the southern oceans isn't without its dangers, which include ice, currents, and container ships. Fred Furey is an oceanographic engineering technician at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research.
These gliders were built and designed in Hawaii. So for us to move it down to the southern ocean is really pushing the limits of what it's made for. And we have had cases where the conditions have actually been just too rough. There was a case last year where we had two of our smaller SP2 wave gliders that ran into trouble, and then we need to make an opportunistic recovery. In the case of these two gliders, we had to charter a sailing boat, and that got us down there in about 5 days in less than ideal conditions, and we had to recover using what we had in the tackle on the ship.
While there have been climate changes throughout the Earth's history, it is the rate of the current increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that has got the scientific community worried. The discovery that the southern ocean phytoplankton bloom periods last longer than previously thought and are performing a bigger function in carbon dioxide storage is significant. It will have a bearing on future climate predictions. But this phytoplankton, which is thought to store significantly more carbon dioxide than tropical forests on land, is itself dependent on the summer storms that bring up nutrients from the deep. So, as we discover the extent of how important southern ocean phytoplankton is for our climate with its carbon storage, the effects of climate change on phytoplankton production are starting to be felt with the changing summer storms. With that, we wrap up today's postcards. For program producer Zhao Jianfu, I'm Wen Jie. See you next week.